Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. On Tuesday, hundreds of scientists and environmental activists held a Stand Up for Science rally near the Moscone Center, the site of the American Geophysical Union's conference in San Francisco. It was attended by over 24,000 scientists, the largest gathering of scientists since the presidential election. At the rally, today's guest, Professor Naomi Oreskes, said, "We are in a frightening moment." She called on scientists to step out of their comfort zones to defend themselves and their work. So how should scientists and the public stand up to Donald Trump and his administration's anti-science policies? What's really at stake with climate deniers and fossil fuel-friendly politicians and executives about to run the U.S. government? Naomi Oreskes is professor of the history of science and affiliated professor of Earth and Planetary Sciences at Harvard University. Her 2010 book, Merchants of Doubt, How a Handful of Scientists Obscured the Truth on Issues from Tobacco to Global Warming, which she co-authored with Eric Conway, was made into a documentary, and you can find it online. Naomi is in town for the conference, and tonight she'll accept the Stephen Schneider Award for Outstanding Climate Science Communication. The award was established in honor of Stephen Henry Schneider, one of the founding fathers of climatology. The event is at 555 Post Street in San Francisco tonight at 6:30, and you can find ticket information at yourcallradio.org. And Naomi Oreskes joins me in studio. Hi, Naomi. Thank you for coming in.
Hi, Rose. Thanks. It's great to be with you again.
Well, it's great to have you back. Last time you were in studio was to talk about your incredible book, Merchants of Doubt. And since then, it's been made into a documentary. We've actually done about three shows, I think, on the documentary because it's so well done.
Thank you.
This book looks at scientists, spinmeisters with very deep connections in politics and industry, and they ran successful campaigns to mislead the public about climate change. Is it fair to say that these merchants of doubt are about to run the government under Donald Trump?
It definitely appears that way. Virtually everyone he's nominated to his cabinet is a climate denier or skeptic of some to some degree or another. And some of the specific people that he has nominated to be part of the EPA transition team in particular are people who have worked directly on climate change denial, people who have worked directly with the think tanks and the organizations that we tracked in our book. And probably one of the most alarming appointments, or I don't know if a transition team is considered an appointment, but one of the members of the transition team is a lawyer named David Schneer. I'm a founding member of the board of the Climate Science Legal Defense Fund. We defend scientists against malicious attacks, harassment, and particularly against the misuse of the FOIA laws, the Freedom of Information Act laws, the misuse of it to harass scientists. And one of the people that we are fighting in court right now as we speak is David Schneer, who has filed malicious FOIA requests against scientists in Arizona, particularly Malcolm Hughes, who's one of the three scientists who worked with Mike Mann in creating the hockey stick curve that proves beyond any reasonable doubt that observed recent climate change is not natural. It's outside the range of natural variability of the last millennium.
Wow. We had Michael Mann on the show on Monday with Tom Tolles.
Oh, great.
And the backlash was so intense after he came out with that hockey stick paper. What sort of backlash have you received? What I loved about the documentary Merchants of Doubt is it goes over the process that you went through to figure out who are these scientists, because it's not just paid people who we've never heard of. Some of these people who are climate deniers are well-established scientists.
Right, exactly. One of the things we wanted to understand, well, let me back up a little. In 2004, I published an article which was the first article in a peer-reviewed journal that looked at the question of the scientific consensus about climate change. And I was simply trying to get a handle on what did the scientific community have to say about climate change, whether it was real, whether it was caused by people. And what I found was really startling. I found that there was an overwhelming consensus among climate scientists that it was real, that it was happening, that it was mostly caused by human activities. And actually that consensus could be tracked back to the 1990s, the early to mid-1990s, and at least in the small sample that I had a sample of about 1,000 papers, there was actually no dissent at all. So I published that paper in Science Magazine, the leading peer-reviewed journal in the United States, and I started getting hate mail. Hmm. I started getting attacked, and I was attacked by name by Senator James Inhofe of Oklahoma, who we all know now as Senator Snowball, but at the time I didn't know who Senator Inhofe was. None of my friends knew. He was not a household name at that time. So it was quite shocking, and I felt it was a sort of Alice through the looking glass moment where suddenly I was in a different world, and you know, right was left and up was down, and everything was very confusing. So I started trying to figure out who these people were and why would I be attacked simply for an article stating a fact, right, that I had analyzed the scientific literature, showed that there was a consensus. In the article, I even explicitly said, the fact of a consensus doesn't tell us what to do about it. That's a different question. Reasonable people could have different opinions on that matter. But there is a fact about what scientists are saying here. And the fact that I got attacked for talking about a fact was a very strange thing. And so I started looking into it, and that's how the whole Merchants of Doubt story unfolded, was digging into that question of who these people were, why they would deny basic scientific facts, why they would deny facts about facts, and discovered the kind of the big tell, which was the link to the tobacco industry.
When we did our show with Michael Mann, we spoke briefly about some of the people who have been appointed, have been chosen by Donald Trump, including Rex Tillerson, former CEO of Exxon, or CEO of Exxon. He has been nominated to be Secretary of State. And then we're just getting word now, Earth Justice just came out with a new Earth Justice just came out with a new information about another team member here. It is Ryan Zink, Montana congressman, as Secretary of the Department of Interior. And according to Earth Justice, he voted against the environment on every major vote. He has measures to increase production of dirty and climate-hating fossil fuels, reduce or eliminate public involvement in the management of public lands, eliminate protections for endangered species. The list goes on and on. I mean, it's hard to keep up with all of these people. What concerns you the most about what you are hearing so far?
Well, it's hard to parse it because it's all so troubling, and it's difficult to say, you know, which piece of this is worse than another piece. It's the totality of it, I suppose, which is what's worst of all. And also the idea that some of these people are so outrageous in their views that a man like Rex Tillerson begins to look reasonable. So, you know, in the last few days, we've had people saying, well, he's not an outright denier. You know, he does acknowledge that climate change might be happening, you know, and he claims to support a carbon tax. But of course, most of that is window dressing. I mean, ExxonMobil has been saying for a long time that they accept the science, but they say one thing with the right hand and they do something else with the left hand. Mm-hmm. And we know and we've documented that while they say things that seem reasonable, they continue to fund climate denial organizations. And we have evidence that this is continuing, you know, even today through their work through trade associations, donors trust, other dark money organizations. Jane Meyer wrote about this in her book, Dark Money. So it's hard to say what's most alarming, but I think, you know, this latest bit about Interior, I mean, this is the whole pattern, right? You're giving agencies to people who want to destroy them. You're giving agencies, whether it's EPA or Interior or the Department of Energy, to people who think those agencies are illegitimate and basically now want to dismantle them, which means to dismantle 50 years of what was previously settled American law, settled American social consensus. And the EPA is particularly heartbreaking because, in a way, this is the culmination of something that's been going on in the Republican Party and the right wing of American politics for a long time. You know, if we go back to the 70s, there was a bipartisan consensus that environmental protection was necessary. Mm-hmm. And the business community supported that because they realized that if the federal government didn't act, the states would. And then we would have a patchwork quilt of different regulations in different states. And that's actually really bad for business. So it'd be bad for the healthy American people, and it would be bad for business. So Richard Nixon created the Environmental Protection Agency. He appointed a wonderful Republican, Bill Ruckelshaus, to head that, a man of great principle and great intelligence. And we had that consensus, but it began to break down in the Reagan years. But then there was pushback, you know, against Reagan's attempts to undermine EPA. And we weathered that storm and we came through it. But nevertheless, for the last 20 years, there's been this steady sort of attempt to chip it away at it, undermine EPA. And one of the most, you know, outrageous things, I mean, there's so many things going on that are so distressing in so many ways, but Scott Pruitt has been fighting the EPA over the Clean Power Plan. And he was quoted in the New York Times as saying, well, the reason I'm opposed to this is because this is executive branch overreach, and this should really be the domain of Congress. Now, if you knew nothing about this history, you might hear that and you might say, oh, well, you know, he has a point, right? It really would be better if Congress would act on this rather than the legislative branch having to do this through, you know, more regulation. And there are legitimate reasons to be cautious about not, you know, executive overreach is a real thing, right? But here's the thing. Pruitt saying this is like the man who kills his parents and then asks for mercy because he's an orphan. He and his colleagues and cronies have done everything possible to stop congressional action. And it's because Congress failed to act that Massachusetts and 13 other states sued the federal government in the case of Mass versus EPA, took the federal government to court under the Clean Air Act, and pointed out that the Clean Air Act, which was passed by Congress, and it's been amended several times but still intact, the Clean Air Act specifically says that the EPA must regulate pollutants that do damage the environment, including effects on weather and climate. We have known since the 1970s that carbon dioxide was a pollutant that could alter the weather and the climate, and it's in the Clean Air Act. So that's why we ended up in court, because Congress was basically failing to obey its own law. The federal government was failing to obey its own law. And the Supreme Court, even with Antonin Scalia on it, agreed with Massachusetts and the other states and ordered the federal government to obey the law. And that's what the Clean Power Plan is. It's the federal government obeying the law under orders from the U.S. Supreme Court. And now Pruitt has the chutzpah to say, oh, that's executive power overreach.
I want to ask you a question that I asked Michael Mann on Monday about the law, because we've done so many shows about these issues over the years, and climate scientists and advocates often say we really don't need new laws because we have such good laws on the books. The problem is they're not being enforced.
Yes.
What happens under these laws under a Trump administration?
Well, I think we don't know. But certainly if you look at the people who he's proposing to appoint, I mean, we can certainly expect that they will not enforce the Clean Power Plan, that they'll retract it. We can expect that they might try to repeal the Clean Air Act. I mean, I think that's not out of the question. I mean, I think we will see an attempt to dismantle the legal framework that has protected the American people and created a level playing field for business. And that's the other part that I feel like the American people really need to understand. This is not about what's good for business. This is what's about good for a small handful of cronies. And especially when we look at ExxonMobil, I mean, the reality is that the oil and gas industry doesn't actually employ all that many people in the United States. And other forms of employment, other forms of industry are much better at creating jobs because the jobs we do get out of oil and gas tend to be boom and bust. They tend to actually be disruptive to communities. So if this were really about growing the economy and bringing jobs to Michigan and Pennsylvania, we would not be putting Rex Tillerson at the head of the State Department.
And, of course, Inside Climate News and the LA Times have done those incredible investigations showing that Exxon knew about climate change in the early 70s and misled the public about it. And Exxon is under investigation for misleading investors and the public. What are your thoughts on what happens to these investigations? Do you think they now have to happen at state levels?
Well, these investigations are happening at the state level. I mean, right now, that's where the most investigative activities taking place, particularly in Massachusetts under Maura Healey, Attorney General Maura Healey, and in New York under Attorney General Eric Schneiderman. But ExxonMobil is already fighting back about this. So, I mean, at minimum, there is an absolutely gargantuan conflict of interest. ExxonMobil is in court trying to prevent state attorneys from investigating it. So that already tells you something about this company. The attorney generals trying to enforce the law of their own states are being fought in court by ExxonMobil, who brought suit in Texas against Maura Healey of Massachusetts. So there's huge jurisdictional issues here. But here's the thing. If Rex Tillerson becomes Secretary of State, now you have a man at the head of one of the most important departments of our government. How can a state attorney fight back against that? Mm-hmm. How can the state attorneys enforce the laws of their own states when the President of the United States has basically put the person who's being investigated, the company that's being investigated, in control of one of the major branches of government?
Today I'm speaking with Naomi Oreskes. She is professor of the history of science and affiliated professor of earth and planetary sciences at Harvard. Her 2010 book, Merchants of Doubt, was made into a documentary. You can watch it online. Naomi is in town for a conference of the American Geophysical Union, attended by over 24,000 scientists. On Tuesday, they took to the streets of San Francisco to hold a Stand Up for Science rally. And tonight she'll accept the Stephen Schneider Award for Outstanding Climate Science Communication. The event is at 630 555 Post Street in San Francisco. You can find ticket information online. And if you'd like to join us, we'd love to hear from you. If you are one of the scientists who is in town for this conference, what are your thoughts on what's happening? How do you think scientists should respond? How should the public respond? And what do you think of coverage of this transition team so far? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. And if you have any questions or comments for Naomi Oreskes, we'd love to hear from you. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. You were at the rally on Tuesday, and you spoke along with other scientists. What are you hearing from your colleagues?
Well, I think most of the people I've spoken to are deeply troubled, deeply worried. I think they're worried on two levels. One, there's simply a personal worry if you're a scientist within the federal government that your job could be at risk, your autonomy, your capacity to do independent, legitimate, objective scientific work might be threatened. So there's some really profound anxiety among scientists who work in federal agencies, and particularly here at the American Geophysical Union. Tremendous number of the people here at this meeting this week work for NASA, work for NOAA, work for the Department of Energy and the National Laboratories. So I think all of these people are quite concerned. I think also the scientific community doesn't really know how to respond, because nothing like this has really happened in America since the 1950s. So it's just beyond the reach of our lifetimes. And maybe that's partly why this is happening. You know, Adlai Stevenson once said the problem with Americans is that we don't read the minutes of the previous meeting. You know, we've sort of forgotten that these things do happen in America, and that the Constitution only protects us if our political leaders and the courts enforce it. And you know, one of the very troubling things about the 1950s is that scientists were targeted for political reasons, and in many cases their universities, I mean, not all, was a mix of what happened, but in many cases public universities were put under so much pressure that they actually didn't protect their people. They didn't protect their scientists. So we don't have a lot of experience dealing with this. We understand that political appointees at the highest level are political. So nobody expects that the head of the EPA is not going to be political. Mm-hmm. And we don't expect the head of the EPA to be a scientist. But what we do expect is that at one level down from that top level of political appointees, that the integrity of the scientific process would be respected, because without that, you know, well, then without that, all hell breaks loose. I mean, and that's the scary, that's the really scary thing. I mean, and it's not just because of the particular people that Donald Trump has proposed. It's everything that's happened in this election, and the very fact that the term post-fact or post-truth, was it post-truth? I've forgotten now. The 2016 word of the year, mm-hmm. post-truth, I think. I mean, just the situation that we now live in, a world where nonsense, disinformation, misinformation, confusion competes in a seemingly equal level with information that is based on, you know, research, investigation, inquiry, that these are now equal, and that the press doesn't seem to know how to stop that, and doesn't seem to know how to differentiate, or doesn't seem willing or able, doesn't feel it's their role. So we live in this sea of disinformation, and it's extremely difficult for scientists to know how to respond, because we don't want to be advocates. We want to be investigators. We've been trained as investigators, and we've been trained to believe that if we do our job properly and we try to be honest and we submit our claims to peer review and we allow our colleagues to criticize them and, you know, to be involved in the normal scientific methods of evaluation and criticism and, you know, what Helen Longino calls the transformative interrogation of science, right? That, you know, we make mistakes as individuals. We know we do. Nobody would say that any individual scientist could be, immune from error or bias. But collectively, we have a process that's designed to sort out claims and to vet, you know, to detect error and to fix it. Mm-hmm. And the idea that that process has now somehow become irrelevant, that basically strikes at our hearts. It strikes at the heart of what we do, and it makes us wonder how we can continue to do what we do in the current environment. So it's a pretty frightening state of affairs.
Naomi Oreskes' paper that she authored, The Scientific Consensus on Climate Change, was featured in Al Gore's documentary An Inconvenient Truth, and then she co-authored the book Merchants of Doubt, which has been turned into a documentary. And let's go to Kevin in Oakland. Hi, Kevin. Welcome to the show.
Hi. My quick question just has to do with the very idea of a scientific consensus. This question is directly for your guest. If science is based, the scientific method is based on the constant answer to a question,
Kevin, I'm sorry, your line, I can't really hear you, but I think you may have also emailed us. Can you please define scientific consensus?
Sure.
He writes, in middle school, we don't learn that any scientific theory or fact should and must be rigorously questioned. If the facts are so well supported, why not stand them up to questioning and cross-examination?
Oh, that's a great question. And the answer is we do. So when people talk about the scientific consensus, no one's saying that this is absolutely positively true and it will never change. We know we can't say that. We know that the process of science is a process of discovery and investigation. And so there's always the possibility that what we've accepted today may be modified tomorrow. But at any given moment in time, you know, if we have to say, what do we know? What do we write in our textbooks? What do we teach to our children? We look at claims that have been vetted, that have been interrogated. We ask, what is the evidence? Is there a lot of evidence? Are there different kinds of evidence? And through that process, scientists sometimes do come to agreement. And the things we call scientific theories, like the theory of plate tectonics, which my first two books were about, are the theories that scientists have come to consensus about. And they've come to that consensus not as a goal. No one is arguing. I would never argue that consensus is the goal of science. I would never argue that scientists should, you know, try to agree and ignore disagreement. Absolutely not. Rather, it's what we would call an emergent property, that sometimes, you know, you have a lot of evidence and scientists work hard. And in the case of plate tectonics, it took about 50 years for scientists to come to consensus and get to the point where they could say, yes, when we have an earthquake here in California, it's because there's motion on the San Andreas Fault, and that motion is the motion of plates, right? And nobody questions that, and there's no disinformation campaign against plate tectonics because there's no economic or political or ideological interest at stake. What's happened in climate change is that exact same process that brought us plate tectonics, and it also, interestingly, took about 50 years from the 50, about 40 years from the 50s to the 90s. It took a long time for scientists to get to the point where they would say, yes, climate change is happening. It's real. It's underway. It's not natural variability. The primary drivers are deforestation and fossil fuel combustion. It took 40 years to get to that point. But scientists did get to that point. And now we write that in our textbooks. But the difference is that we've been subject to a gigantic disinformation campaign that's been going on for about 20 years now and has been so effective that many of us now are confused and don't know what to think.
Well, and you're being hit from all sides because not only is Exxon CEO Rex Tillerson nominated to be Secretary of State, but then there's Betsy DeVos, the nominee for Secretary of Education. We're going to do a show about this next week. But I wanted to ask you about this New Yorker piece by Lawrence Krauss. The Trump administration is on course to undermine science in another way through education. Educators have various concerns about Betsy DeVos, Trump's nominee for Secretary of Education, but one issue stands above the rest. DeVos is a fundamentalist Christian with a long history of opposition to science. If her faith shapes her policies, and there's evidence that it will, she could shape science education for the worse by depriving young people in an era where biotech will play a key economic and health worldview of a proper understanding of the very basis of modern biology, and that is evolution.
Yeah, well, that's right. So one of the things that's already been going on in this country, again, for the better part of 15 or 20 years, is the attempt to teach religion in science classrooms. Now, I consider myself a religious person. I have huge respect for the diversity of religious belief in America. Literally, some of my best friends, one of my best friends is Jim Antle, the wonderful head of the United Church of Christ in Massachusetts. But religion is not science. And the Constitution is clear that we're not supposed to establish religion in America. And one of the things that's very pernicious, there's two things that are pernicious, actually, about the attempt to teach, say, creationism in public schools. I mean, one is that it conflates religion with science, and these are different things, and you cannot teach science properly if you conflate it with religion or politics or anything else. So in science classrooms, we need to teach science. And the economic reasons that Krauss mentions are, one, it's not the only one, though. There are many good reasons for learning science beyond simply the utilitarian value. But also, one of the profound hypocrisies of the people who have been pushing for creationism in public school, they're not pushing for the teaching of a diversity of religious views. They're not pushing to teach, you know, Jewish views of creation or Buddhist views of creation or Hindu views of creation or even the United Churches of Christ view. They're pushing to view a very specific fundamentalist evangelical Christian view. And that is the establishment of religion, because they're taking a particular religious view and privileging it over others. So it's fundamentally noxious to our teaching of science, but it's also fundamentally noxious to our basic constitutional principles of the separation of church and state.
Naomi Oreskes is professor of the history of science and affiliated professor of earth and planetary sciences at Harvard. She's author of Merchants of Doubt, which has been turned into a documentary. She is in town for the American Geophysical Union's conference, and tonight she'll accept the Stephen Schneider Award for Outstanding Climate Science Communication. Tonight at 6:30, it's an open event. You can find ticket information at yourcallradio.org, 555 Post Street, downtown San Francisco. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this.
This is Your Call here on 91.7 KALW San Francisco. There are many ways you can take part in the conversation on Your Call. On the phone, by sending an email to feedback@yourcallradio.org, or going to yourcallradio.org, the website. If you'd like to participate in today's show by telephone, you're welcome to call us toll-free, 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255. You can also tweet us at yourcallradio.org.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, it's our media roundtable. We'll discuss coverage of Russia's possible intervention in the U.S. presidential election. And then we will discuss coverage of ExxonMobil CEO Rex Tillerson and his possible transition from the boardroom to the State Department. So much coverage has been on his relationship with Russia, but the company has done business in more than 23 countries, including Saudi Arabia and Iraqi Kurdistan. So we'll also talk about that. Today, we're joined by Naomi Oreskes, professor of the history of science and affiliated professor of earth and planetary sciences at Harvard. Check out her book, Merchants of Doubt, and the documentary by the same name. She is in town for the American Geophysical Union's conference. A number of scientists took to the streets on Tuesday for a Stand Up for Science rally, and Naomi will be receiving the Stephen Schneider Award for Outstanding Climate Science Communication tonight at 555 Post Street at 6:30, and you can find more information at yourcallradio.org. And if you'd like to join us, the toll-free number is 866-798-8255. If you're a scientist in town, we'd love to hear from you. What is your reaction to what we're seeing with Donald Trump's possible administration? How are you planning to fight back? You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. And let's go next to Greg in Palo Alto. Hi, Greg. Welcome to the show.
Hello. Thank you. A couple of comments. One, I heard a woman who was attending the conference in San Francisco, I think she was one of the scientists, was saying that she didn't understand the lack of a sense of urgency on the part of her colleagues with regard to this issue. And I somewhat agree, although I don't know how extensive the effort is being made by scientists, but it seems to me that people are going to have to start coming up with strategies to confront this, and I think particularly they're going to have to do it at the local and state levels. That's where I think the battle is going to have to be fought, and I think that people can't rely on the Democrats to do this. They would have done it already if they had, but that's where pressure needs to be applied. And it's clear that people are going to have to really organize, because these nominations are horrible. It remains to be seen how much, how far to the right they're going to go. But this is going to be ending up being a war. I'm glad that Brown struck, at least he was posturing, but I hope he's willing to take on the national government and fight this. And I would like to see scientists, although maybe they're not comfortable being political, they're going to have to be political. They're the ones who know about this, and they're going to have to start putting pressure on people in the media, et cetera, to try and get this message out. And I hope, California is going to fight this tooth and nail.
And if anyone hasn't been following that piece of news, Governor Jerry Brown said he's going to fight Donald Trump on climate. He says, we've got the scientists, we've got the lawyers, and we're ready to fight.
Yes, well, I agree with our caller. Thank you for that. And Jerry Brown did speak at AGU yesterday, and I was not able to go myself because I was in a workshop with scientists for the Climate Science Legal Defense Fund, trying to teach scientists how to defend themselves against attacks. But I did hear that Jerry was fabulous, and he did speak very clearly and in a very determined way about his commitment to science and to fighting climate change. So I think that's extremely important, because I think our caller's right. We desperately need leadership, and we're not going to get it. I don't know. We don't know where leadership is going to come from. Let me rephrase that. I think we need people to speak up on all levels and to think about the ways that we can push back against this and resist this on all levels. And I agree that I think right now the most promising place to look is the state and local level. And if you think about all the states that did vote for Hillary, all the states where it was close, all the states where millions of people do care about a whole set of issues that Donald Trump does not care about. Or if you look at, there's a really great new poll data from the George Washington University Yale group on climate. And their latest data shows that 70% of the American people do support the Paris Accord, and only 13% of us want President Trump to pull America out of the climate accord. Only 13%. So that tells you that actually the American people are great. Most of us are not in denial about climate change. Most of us want action, but somehow there's a disconnect between what we want and what we're about to get. Mm. So we have to figure out how to fix that. And right now, I do think that the best way to think about that is on the state and local level. And especially because, and I'm working on trying to develop a paper on this with I have a terrific postdoc, Jeffrey Supran, who ran the fossil-free MIT movement when he was a graduate student at MIT. He's now working with me. And one of the things we've been talking about is that if you look at where most of the carbon emissions in the United States come from, they come from the places with the strongest economies, because greenhouse gas emissions are associated with economic activity. And actually, those tend to be the states that voted for Hillary Clinton, not the states that voted for Donald Trump. That means those are states where there's strong political support for action on climate. So if those states would follow the lead of California and act to control their greenhouse gases on the state level, we could actually make huge progress on this issue. So that's actually my message to everybody. Get active on the state level or, join your local citizens' climate lobby. Find a way to work closer to home, because I think we could get a lot done. And then we also demonstrate our will to the rest of the American people. And we also demonstrate that this can be fixed, because part of the big lie, part of the denial is to say we can't fix it. So even already you're hearing some shifting among some of the Trump people. Well, yeah, maybe there's climate change, but it's not really serious and we can't fix it, or the fix would be too expensive. And that's a big lie, because we can fix it. It's going to be hard. It's not going to be easy. It's not going to happen overnight. But we do have the policy instruments, the technology, the science to point in the right direction for how we begin to fix, you know, how we begin to turn this battleship around and fix this big problem.
Right. And in California, we're going to do a show about this in the new year.
Right.
Democrats now have a supermajority in Sacramento, meaning they do not need one Republican vote to pass anything.
Yeah.
And also, California just adopted the country's first energy-saving rules for computers.
Yeah, great.
When they're just sitting idle all day.
Great. And just one thing about the supermajority, yeah. I mean, obviously that's good from a political standpoint here in California, but I would really encourage everyone here, don't write off the Republicans. There are good Republicans in this state, and many of them care about climate change. Many of them have been outspoken about climate change, and we need them as allies because even though here in California we could proceed without them, we're not going to proceed without them in a lot of other states. We need those Republican voices. We need those Republicans talking about how we can end subsidies for fossil fuels, which, you know, Republicans should not be in favor of subsidies to the world's richest corporations. So I would encourage everyone here in California to be thinking about reaching out to your Republican friends, because they are here, your potential allies, I guess I could say. It's very, very important that we don't discount the Republican voices on this issue.
In the Merchants of Doubt film, I don't remember what his name is.
Bob Inglis.
Thank you.
Yeah.
A Republican who did a 180 and started advocating on climate change,
right.
Went on right-wing radio shows and talked about his trip to, was it Antarctica?
Antarctica.
Yeah. And he talked about that. I thought that was really interesting. Are you in touch with any Republicans who maybe don't want to go on record who are just frightened about what's happening right now, especially
yes.
on this issue?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And I mean, Bob Inglis is a hero. I count him now as a friend. Bob is doing fantastic work traveling the country, speaking to young Republican groups. And he has said that lots of young Republicans are not in denial. They understand that climate change is a real issue. But what they would like to see is the best solution, the most effective solution that can be done with the least amount of government. And I think that's okay. I don't think we have to be troubled by that. To the extent that we can fix this problem with market-based mechanisms or by eliminating perverse incentives for fossil fuels. I mean, Bob always says the reason he supports a price on carbon is because we should be taxing the thing we don't want, which is pollution, and not taxing the thing or taxing less the thing we do want, which is income. And I think that's right. And I think that's an argument that a lot of Democrats, independents, progressives can get on board with. And it's a place we can find common ground and maybe, you know, make some progress. Again, I don't expect we'll make progress with President Trump on this issue, but I think we can make progress on the state level with many state legislators.
Let's go next to Mark in Oakland. Hi, Mark.
Hi, Rose. Thanks for taking my call. I believe that we are, I believe in climate change, but I don't understand why we can't accept the fact that fossil fuels, carbon-based fuels, are finite, and it's why not? It's better to try to move away from those fuels now. Why wait until things are even worse? So, aside from trying to convince people that we're heating up the planet, we just tell them, look, we're running out of our trust fund, and it's time to get to work. I don't understand we don't take that approach. Thanks.
That's a great question, and I am happy to say that I can answer it. I mean, there's two reasons. The first one is the obvious one, which is money. Companies like ExxonMobil and Chevron and BP, Shell, make huge amounts of money off oil, gas. Peabody Coal is now bankrupt, but that's because they were mismanaged, not because they didn't at one point make a lot of money. Fossil fuels are incredibly profitable, and as long as they remain profitable, these companies will continue to try to burn, drill, mine as much of it as they can. So we're fighting against a very, very powerful economic interest. But if you ask the question from a sort of strategy standpoint, well, why can't we make the case to our fellow citizens that they're going to run out and so it's wise? The problem with that argument is that they won't run out fast enough. Scientists talk about the so-called carbon budget, the amount of carbon that we can put into the atmosphere without causing, you know, really serious grave consequences. And it's very clear from many high-quality studies that the amount of fossil fuels that exists in the world is way greater, much, much greater than the carbon budget. And particularly this is true of coal. Even here in the United States, we have more than 100 years of coal reserves. And there are huge coal reserves in China, India, many places around the globe. There are still very, very substantial oil and gas reserves in the Arctic. This is why the Rex Tillerson appointment is so troubling, because he's striking deals with Putin to drill in the Arctic. So the problem is we can't wait till they run out. they're not running out fast enough, and the price won't go up high enough, probably based on simply arguments about limited resources. So that's why that argument isn't really sufficient to get us to move quickly enough to solve this problem before it's too late.
Thank you for calling in, Mark. Let's go next to Ruthann in El Cerrito. Hi, Ruthann.
Good morning. I wanted to ask, I have been pursuing the Think Globally, Act Locally strategy that I think Naomi Oreskes is endorsing. And being in California, Governor Brown touts how he's just the green energy king and caring on about CO2 emissions and everything, and he's a big endorser of fracking. And I call the office constantly wanting, his office, wanting to put in a message that, you know, how can you be the big climate change person and not, you know, prohibit fracking the way they did in New York? And I'm just curious what Naomi Oreskes thinks of the dichotomy between being limiting carbon emissions and endorsing fracking at the same time.
You know, I'm not familiar with the details of the governor's position on fracking, so I can't speak for him. The only thing I could say with respect to fracking is the following. A lot of people have accepted the idea of gas as a bridge fuel because the emissions associated with gas are lower than those associated with coal or oil. My position has always been that gas could be a bridge fuel if the use of gas is coupled with other policies to ensure that we begin the rapid movement away from fossil fuels and towards renewables. So here in California, California is the only place in the United States where those policies actually are in place. So here in California, I do think there's a plausible argument to make. I'm not saying I agree with it, but it's not insane. It's not crazy that with these other policies in place, we can use gas, you know, in the next decade or so, particularly in electricity generation, to use it as a bridge fuel while we ramp up solar, wind, energy efficiency, and grid integration. So I think that's probably the argument, but you would have to look into the governor's office, you know, go to the website or statements to know for sure what his argument is.
He actually got a lot of flack over the years for refusing to ban fracking in California groups like Food and Water Watch.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. And oh, actually, there is news that he is going to seek a permanent ban on offshore oil drilling along the California coast.
Yeah. Well, that's good, in my opinion.
All right. Well, thanks for that, Ruthann. And let's go next to Marie Louise in Palo Alto. Hi. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. Good morning. I'm calling to say I have never myself been to China, but I have seen a number of photographs and film clips, and my son was in Beijing at one point and said he could not see across the street because of, you know, the pollution, the smog, etc., from his hotel room, that is. And I think that if we could somehow get a hold of more of this, perhaps some people could at least be reached by the fact that perhaps their children or grandchildren are going to have to be wearing masks a lot of the time if we don't change this. So that's what I wanted to say. Because I think even people who are climate change denier may have children and grandchildren.
Yes, <know? laughs> I think that's a great point. And I often try to stress that when I speak to scientists, that I think one of the mistakes that scientists sometimes make is they talk about climate change in much too abstract terms. You know, scientists love numbers, so we talk about 350 parts per million or doubling of CO2, or we talk about the climate sensitivity being 2 to 3 degrees. So it's numbers, 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 which we know from advertising, marketing, and ordinary life that that's not what moves most people. What moves most people is who they love and what they love and what they care about. And we all love our children. You know, Democrats, Republicans, Independents, we might be a divided country, but we all love our children. And I think to the extent that we can remind everyone that we're not talking about something in the far off distant future now. We are talking about something that is beginning to affect us already here and now in California, in Texas, in Florida, in Massachusetts, and will very strongly affect our children and their well-being, their prosperity, and their opportunities. So thank you for that. I think it's an extremely important point.
Mm. Thank you, Marie Louise. Let's go next. We have time for a few more callers to Scott in San Francisco. Hi, Scott.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I was wondering if your guest could talk about the part that the beef industry plays in impacting climate change and how that might be made worse in the Trump administration?
Oh, that's a great question. You know, it's funny. I don't talk about food a lot because my own training is in physical sciences. I'm an earth scientist by training and a historian of earth science. And I'm very mindful in my work to try to, you know, stay close to my areas of expertise and not pontificate on things where I haven't done my homework. So I don't talk about food a lot, but you're absolutely right. A tremendous amount of greenhouse gas emissions are associated with agriculture, forestry, and other land use changes. About 40% of all greenhouse gas emissions fall into those non-energy categories. So agriculture of various kinds, forestry of various kinds, and other land use changes. So certainly when we think about the problem of empowerment and disempowerment, one of the things that individuals can do is to eat less meat and to eat less animal products in general. And that's a relatively easy thing to do, in my opinion, because you don't have to be a vegetarian or a vegan. You just have to scale it back a bit. And if all of us just, you know, moderated how much animal products we ate, that makes a significant contribution. Now, I believe we absolutely will see pushback from the beef industry. I think there's no question. We've already seen it. I did work with the filmmaker Robbie Kenner. When we made Merchants of Doubt, our filmmaker was Robbie Kenner, who made the film Food Inc. So if anyone here thinks that the beef industry is just a kind of altruistic organization giving us good food, they absolutely have to watch the film Food Inc.
Do you think that under a Trump administration, individual action is now more important than it was 2 months ago?
Yes, but maybe not for the reason people think. I mean, I actually think the most important thing right now is actually not individual action. I think it's organizing.
Well, in addition to organizing.
Right, I think you have to do both.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that individuals alone, I mean, look, if you look at history, look at civil rights, gay rights, women's rights, women's suffrage movement, the anti-Vietnam War movement, social change is not created by disorganized individuals. It's created by people who are organized. And I think a lot about Rosa Parks, because when I was in school, we were taught about Rosa Parks as if she were just a nice lady coming home from work one day who was tired and didn't want to get up out of her seat. And that's what I was taught in school. And my children have told me that's what they were taught in school. And my children, by the way, grew up here in California. So in progressive California, we were taught that Rosa Parks was just an individual. But that's not true. She was part of a movement. That moment was planned. It was scripted. It was thought through. And the symbolism of the bus seat was a important idea for the civil rights movement. So it's extremely important for all of us to think about who can we work with? How can we get organized? And I'm telling everyone who asks me, pick an organization and join it, whether it's Citizens Climate Lobby or 350 or Mothers Out Front or the Voter Participation Project. There are a lot of great organizations doing great work on the ground, and we all need to be working with them. That said, I also think individual action is extremely important, but the main reason is so you don't get depressed, because it's very easy to feel depressed by this issue. It's such a big issue. Yeah. It's very easy to feel disempowered. So you can change your light bulbs. I've swapped all my light bulbs to LED. They're great. A little bit of upfront cost, but you save money in the long run. My house is solar paneled. All of our electricity is now from solar powers. And that has also an effect on your friends and neighbors, because once we got our solar panels up, neighbors started emailing us to ask us, how did we do it? How much did it cost? And so, you know, by acting, you can prevent the feeling of disempowerment and despair, and you can also be a positive influence among the people around you.
And just for some information, according to Mother Jones, the person that will probably be picked to head the USDA, Heidi Heitkamp, apparently trolled the Humane Society. She heads a group that defends puppy mills. So we'll have to
Charming.
Do a show around that.
Yeah. One thing, do we have a minute to say? In California, though, we just passed a law. We had a referendum. Sorry, not California. Sometimes I forget where I live because I really wish I still lived in California. California's home. In Massachusetts, where I live now, we passed a referendum to improve humane treatment of animals. Mm. And that passed by a pretty large margin. So there's a good example of how you can work on the state level.
Yes. All right. Well, thank you. Let's take one more call. Tom, we don't have much time. Welcome to the show.
Yes, I'm curious. There are 6 billion people in the world. If we were to average everything out, does everybody get a car? Does everybody get an electric stove? Does everybody get a refrigerator before we cross the boundary where of 350?
Well, that's a great question. We've already crossed the 350 boundary. I mean, we're already over 400 parts per million CO2 and probably about 480 or 490 CO2 equivalent. So that's all the different greenhouse gases that contribute to climate change. So this is why scientists are so worried now, because we actually have, you know, we've crossed that 350 boundary. But in terms of your first question, the central question, this is the really big issue, right? And it's the issue that we have to sort out. We can't fix this problem by telling 2 billion people on Earth that they have to stay mired in poverty. Mm-hmm. But the big lie, well, this is now the fourth or fifth big lie that we've tried to, is that what they need is oil, gas, or coal. And Bob Inglis speaks to this very eloquently in our film. People need energy, but they don't need fossil fuels. And in fact, there's a lot of good reason. There's good social science research. There's good experience on the ground that actually distributed forms of energy like solar and wind are actually better for a lot of communities in countries that, for example, don't have effective and efficient electricity grids. You can build – there are people now working in India bringing electricity to villages that have never had it 100% solar, and they've improved the lives of these people. They have more light so they can work at night. They can earn more money. So this small thing, solar power in a village, can radically improve the quality of life, the standard of living for these people. And you don't need oil. You don't need gas. You don't need coal. And you don't even need an electricity grid. And that's actually a huge, huge thing to know, and a huge source of optimism that these sorts of models can be very effective in poor countries.
Thank you for the call, Tom. Naomi Oreskes is professor of the history of science and affiliated professor of earth and planetary sciences at Harvard University. Her 2010 book, Merchants of Doubt, was made into a documentary. You can find it online. Actually, this would be a great film to watch with family over the holidays.
That's especially, nice of you to say.
Really, I mean, if you have any climate deniers or Trump voters in your family, it'd be a good one to watch. Naomi is in town for the American Geophysical Union's conference, and tonight she'll accept the Stephen Schneider Award for Outstanding Climate Science Communication. It's at 6:30, 555 Post Street, downtown San Francisco. You can find information online, yourcallradio.org. Naomi, thank you for your work, and thanks for coming in.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Thank you, and thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call. On the next Your Call, it's our media roundtable. This week, we'll discuss ongoing coverage of Russia's possible intervention in the U.S. presidential election. We'll also look at ExxonMobil CEO Rex Tillerson and his transition from the boardroom to the State Department. Most coverage has been on his relationship with Russia, but the company has done business in more than 23 countries, including Chad, Saudi Arabia, and Iraqi Kurdistan. Join us at 10 a.m. on the next Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To listen to past shows or sign up for our podcast, visit yourcallradio.org. Laura Flynn produces the show. Malihe Razazan is senior producer. Matt Martin is executive producer. And Helena Murphy is our intern and researcher. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer. And Kevin Vance is our studio engineer. Our theme music is performed and composed by Live Human. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.
Coming up on the next Tavis Smiley Show from PRI, Dr. Nadine Burke-Harris discusses the fight against the long-term effects of childhood trauma. Then we'll rebroadcast my conversations with historian Craig Wilder, who talks about slavery and capitalism, Earth, Wind, and Fire bassist Verdeen White, and Oscar winner Jeremy Irons on the next Tavis Smiley Show from PRI.
Tavis, tomorrow at 12 noon here on 91.7. KLW's December renewal letters have just gone out. If your membership is about to expire, please take a moment to renew and join the other 10,000 members and listeners who provide 72% of our financial support. Send your contribution by mail or click on the donate button at klw.org, and thank you for keeping KLW strong and independent. World Have Your Say from the BBC is next. It was recorded earlier for broadcast at this time. It's KLW San Francisco at 11 o'clock.
Hello, I'm Chloe Tilley. Welcome to World Have Your Say. We begin in Syria.
It took 4,000 years to build Aleppo, hundreds of generations, One generation managed to tear it down in 4 years.
The long-awaited evacuation of eastern Aleppo has begun. Rebels, civilians and people who are wounded have started to leave the besieged Syrian city on government green buses. We'll hear the story of the day with the help of Syrians and aid agencies. Plus, we'll hear from pilots as an international study found 4% were suicidal yet still flying. And should students from poor backgrounds get an easier route to university? Bristol University here in the UK will offer places to students with results 2 grades lower than their more affluent counterparts. But is it fair? We'll speak to students.